Welcome to another episode of Naval History and Heritage Command's Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy. I'm your host, Cliff Davis. For this episode, in recognition of November being National Aviation History Month, we're going to be celebrating the Navy's path to flight by highlighting the establishment and development of naval aviation over the last 100 plus years, along with some of its defining moments and technological advancements, and how naval aviation plays a crucial role in modern day society. Hill Goodspeed, the Deputy Director of the National Naval Aviation Museum, located in Pensacola, Florida, is joining me in the studio via phone. How are you doing today, Hill?
I'm doing fine, Cliff. How are you today?
Good, thank you. So would you mind giving our listeners a bit about your background and your interest in naval aviation and naval history?
Sure. I have been at the National Naval Aviation Museum for over 30 years. My initial job here was the historian, which that was a role I filled for up until just a couple of years ago when I became deputy director. I come from a naval aviation background. My grandfather got his wings of gold at NAS Pensacola in 1941, just a couple of months before Pearl Harbor, and also married into a naval aviation family. My wife's grandfather was an enlisted pilot and eventually rose to become the personal pilot for the Chief of Naval Operations. So he had, for his passing, shared a lot of stories about some of the big names in naval aviation who he and the Navy in general who he flew over the years. And my father-in-law was a Marine pilot in Vietnam and afterwards. So, come from a naval aviation family and also born here in Pensacola, with the cradle of naval aviation. So I was fortunate enough to get a position here and have been here for a while and still enjoying it. It's a great place to work and very rewarding profession.
Well, it certainly sounds like naval aviation flows through your veins.
Absolutely does.
As we're here today to talk about national aviation history, focusing on the Navy's history of flight, I want to first ask about the early history and development of naval aviation. What were some of the key factors that led to its establishment?
Well, part of it was a drive by what passed for the aircraft manufacturing industry, and industries probably being a generous term. There were some aircraft manufacturers following the first flight of the Wright brothers. One were the Wright brothers themselves. Another one was a gentleman named Glenn Curtiss. And they, as the aircraft was developing and the possibilities were developing, certainly there was a courting of the military as to introducing this new creation to see how it might enhance military capabilities and operations. And then on the other hand, the military itself, there had to be some individuals who were forward thinking as to what the airplane could bring to the table tactically and technologically. So you had to have two sides of the coin, and both of them came together. And in the case of the Navy, it was a gentleman named Glenn Curtiss, who was started off as a champion motorcycle racer, used to race on Daytona Beach, as a matter of fact, and then branched into aircraft. And he approached an individual or made contact with an individual in the Navy who was a gentleman named Captain Washington Irving Chambers. And Chambers was not an aviator. He was a battleship officer and was actually assigned the duty of handling aviation correspondence, which was not plentiful back then, as part of his official duties in Washington. And this was around 1910. And he really, despite his background, had an open mind to it and embraced the possibility. So he worked in close concert with Glenn Curtiss, and the two of them developed these operations that were really significant, and they were the first shipboard operations involving an aircraft in naval history. And so there was a civilian pilot named Eugene Ely, who was actually from Iowa, who far as far away from the oceans as possible. But he was the one that actually made the first launch and or takeoff and landing on a ship. And this occurred on two occasions, in November 1910 and January 1911. And in January 1911, he actually landed on a ship, USS Pennsylvania, turned around and launched from that same ship. And in November 1910, he launched from USS Birmingham. But the Pennsylvania landing was significant because that's really what sets naval aviation apart from other military aviation, is the ability to operate from a ship, especially to land on one. And he did that. The ship was stationary. And he made the landing in this little biplane pusher aircraft, which means the engine propeller were located behind the pilot with the propeller facing aft or to the rear. And he had these little hooks positioned on the strut, the wheel strut, And these hooks actually, when he landed, engaged ropes weighted down by sandbags on either side. So that was the first so-called arrested landing, which is the forerunner of what you see on carriers today. But those were some early experiments showing what an aircraft could do aboard a ship. And then Curtis went even further. He knew that ships, that there were no special built ships to operate aircraft with flight decks on them. So he knew that seaplanes were going to be important, that a ship, for a ship to operate an aircraft, it had to have the ability to just be put over the side and use the runway that a body of water provided and then be able to be pulled back aboard the ship. So he also focused on seaplanes and made some demonstration flights with those. And that led to the Navy really setting aside some money, which was a huge total of $25,000, which is actually pretty significant back then in 1911, to procure a couple of aircraft. And Glenn Curtis threw in the training of the pilot, the first pilots. And so the first naval aviator was a lieutenant named Theodore Ellison. And Curtis started to train those early pilots. And then the Wright brothers got into the mix, and they also trained some early pilots. And then the combination of the two, the Navy just started to procure aircraft and build up a very rudimentary aviation force. And so that's really how it got started. But it was primarily, you know, even though Ely made the flight, civilian pilot, it was most of the early operations were centered on seaplanes and what they could bring to the fleet, which was initially not any sort of combat capability, but mainly reconnaissance, the ability to fly over to a higher altitude and see what the enemy might be doing. And the other initial purpose that they viewed aircraft as carrying out was spotting the fall of gunfire. So if you were to look at how navies battled each other over the course of the centuries, essentially it was two ships getting in close proximity and slugging it out with cannons and later on other more advanced armament. And the ability to spot the enemy was key. If you had the ability to see the enemy at a greater distance, detect where they were before he detected where you were, and then the ability to maneuver your ship into a favorable firing position, that was a great advantage. Well, before the airplane, you really, the extent of that battle space that where you could see the opposing ship was how far you could see from the tallest mast on your ship. But if you had aircraft and the ability to protect those aircraft in the sky, the battle space was dramatically expanded, and you would be able to see the disposition of the enemy and enable your fleet to be in a more favorable position as opposed to the enemy fleet if you had semblance of control of the air. So those were generally the first purposes for early aircraft in those pioneer days.
Right. And what were some of the technological advancements that shaped early naval aviation?
Well, certainly it was, from an aircraft perspective, aircraft became a little sturdier as far as the ability to withstand the elements. I mean, they were wooden fabric initially, and they continued to be for a period of time, but they started to enclose the cockpit area in aircraft. And because the early ones, actually, the seat was just positioned right above a central pontoon, and actually there weren't even any seat belts in some of the early aircraft. Actually, the first fatality in naval aviation was a young ensign named William Billingsley, who, on a flight over the Chesapeake Bay, the aircraft suddenly hit an updraft, and it actually threw him out of the airplane. And so that was one development with seat belts technologically and actually enclosing the cockpit area. Another development was to shift the engines from the pusher engine, as I described earlier, where the engine was located behind the pilot and the propeller facing aft, to put actually that in the front part of the airplane. Also to have multi-engine type airplanes. And that was another advancement. So those were, from a design standpoint, were elements. Another thing was just the development of the engines themselves. And eventually, as you go from the early days into the 20s and time frame, you shifted from water-cooled engines with radiators to air-cooled engines. And that was one thing. The air-cooled engines tended to be more capable, but also from a maintenance perspective, they were also favorable because they weren't as heavy. or weren't as difficult or complicated. And also from a uniquely naval perspective, they weren't as heavy, which decreased weight, which also enabled them to operate from ships in an easier fashion. And also made them, if you're flying over water and you have water cool engine in your radiator, all of a sudden springs a leak, you're going to be in dire straits. So the air cooled engines eliminated that. And so those are some of the technological advances. And of course, by the early 30s, you start to see metal construction, you start to see enclosed cockpit canopies and radial engines. And so all that is influencing how aircraft are used in naval operations.
If you don't mind, I want to briefly backtrack and ask how those advancements evolved and helped contribute to the Allied victory in World War I, along with proving that naval aviation was possibly a way moving forward for the Navy from its battleship mentality.
Well, absolutely. World War I is, if you look at World War I and naval aviation's contributions, what is most impressive is not actually what naval aviation personnel did in the course of operations. It's what the lessons they learned and what the war spawned in naval operations. So, and what that means is, so when the U.S. entered World War I, in April 1917, it was definitely well behind the other allies who were fighting as far as technology was concerned. So none of the aircraft the U.S. Navy had in the inventory could remotely compete with what was being flown on the Western Front. And because if you look throughout history, wars and the necessity of, or just the tremendous pressure you're under during war to hastily develop weapons that will enable you to gain an advantage over the enemy, it really spawns technology and makes it move at a very rapid rate when compared to peacetime. And so by the time the U.S. entered World War I, the Allied powers had aircraft and capabilities and experience that far exceeded the U.S. So there weren't a tremendous number of U.S. aircraft that went overseas. A lot of naval aviators flew foreign aircraft types, and they were actually even went through some elements of flight training after they left the United States to learn to fly these types of airplanes. They received instruction from the Royal Air Force, for example, the French, and also the Italians. So naval aviation was able, when they got into combat, they performed well. Navy's first fighter ace was an individual named David Ingalls. He actually achieved that feat, which is scoring 5 or more air-to-air kills or shootdowns. That's how you become an ace. So he did that while, in essence, what you would call today an exchange pilot with the Royal Air Force. And you had also individuals who were operating in squadrons that did a lot of anti-submarine work, patrolling from a series of naval air stations that were constructed along the coast of France and also in England and Ireland, flying anti-submarine warfare patrol. You also had some aviators and personnel who were part of something called the Northern Bombing Group, which was some of the first strategic bombing ever carried out by U.S. forces was an element of the operations of the strategic bombing. But as I said, what is really important about World War I is what the Navy learned. And one was the ability to mobilize. If you look at the statistics of what the number of aircraft on hand and the number of personnel in the ranks of naval aviation in April 1917 and what the state of the organization was in November 1918, the leap is dramatic. And so it really taught individuals who ultimately ended up playing very important roles as senior officers in World War I, it taught them those lessons on mobilization and training to get the necessary personnel into the positions they needed to be in on the front line. And also what it taught naval aviation was the importance of, or the ability to operate aircraft at sea. So a lot of naval aviation personnel were able to observe what the Royal Navy was doing, and the British Royal Navy developed aircraft carriers actually during World War I to operate wheeled aircraft from ships. And so the ability for naval aviation personnel to observe their British counterparts doing this planted a seed in their minds. So when they came back after World War I and looked at where airplane could take the Navy, because World War One had established that the airplane was going to be an important part of warfare going forward. Now these U.S. officers coming back, having observed what the Royal Navy was doing, were able to influence the U.S. Navy and plant the seed of what will become aircraft carrier aviation, which is something that exists to this day. So that so really what came out of World War One are those elements that really played a major role in what happened in World War II.
So technology and innovation are spawned by war, correct?
Right. Absolutely.
Now we're learning new techniques from the British Royal Navy on aircraft carriers and how they operate from sea. But how was naval aviation prepared for a possible Second World War?
Well, like all countries that suffered from the effects of the Great Depression, there were trying economic times that limited to a degree military budgets and expansion. And there were a series of treaties, disarmament treaties that occurred, the Washington Naval Treaty being one and the London Naval Treaty being another. And so there were efforts on the part of nations to try to limit the ship construction in the world's navies, because it had been a very expensive naval buildup leading to World War One, and World War One was called the war to end all wars, and people viewed having another world war as being a catastrophic thing. So there were pretty naive attempts, if you look back on it in hindsight, to almost disarm the world so another world war wouldn't occur, and of course, which didn't happen. So, but despite those hindrances, and just the inter-Navy or the conflict within the Navy itself as far as what was going to be a capital ship and what was going to be a primary weapon going forward, naval aviation was able to develop. There were a number of dedicated individuals who were actually aviators who had come up during the World War One time frame and instilled within the Navy a spirit of, hey, we're going to advance naval aviation. We really believe that it's going to ultimately change the face of naval warfare. And these were primarily junior officers, so they didn't have a lot of rank. So what they did is they benefited from a couple of individuals who, at the more senior ranks, that also recognized the importance of naval aviation. One of those was William Moffett, who was the first chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics, which was the administrative side of naval aviation, which secured funding, and he walked the halls of Congress. He cultivated the public through newspapers and other media of the day, and also air racing, which captured the public's imagination. So Admiral Moffett, from the administrative side, sold naval aviation in Washington and elsewhere. And then in the fleet, there was a gentleman named Joseph Mason Reeves, who eventually rose to 4-star rank. And he was considered the father of fleet aviation. Moffett was considered the father of naval aviation. And in fleet operations, he's the one that took what the aviation personnel were saying about the airplane and its capabilities and actually integrated that with fleet operations using the Navy's first aircraft carrier, USS Langley, and also two giant carriers, which were permitted under the Washington Naval Treaty, the USS Lexington, USS Saratoga. And through operations at sea, including a series of war games called Fleet Problems, Reeves and those that followed honed naval aviation's capabilities. They would do all sorts of things, practicing various tactics to develop ones that would succeed at sea. And a great example of that was the tactic of dive bombing. If you were going to attack a ship from the air, torpedo attack is one way, but if you're going to bomb a ship from the air, there were two methods you could do. If you flew horizontally, like an Army Air Force's bomber, like the B-17, for example, and drop bombs from high altitude, that was not going to be effective against a moving ship. It would be effective against a factory or something like that that was stationary, but against a ship, it wasn't going to be. So one of the tactics developed was something called dive bombing, which eventually would be perfected in a way where aircraft would dive at 70-degree angles and plummet toward the target and about 1,500 to 1,000 feet above the water or the land, they would release their bomb. And so in effect, the aviator would be aiming his bomb at a moving ship, and that would really was much more effective. So that was one of the tactics they developed in the interwar years. So by the time of Pearl Harbor, the U.S. fleet, it had a number of carriers, less than 10, but those ships were able to, during the early months of World War II, not only hold the line in the Pacific, but also engage in hit-and-run raids and also great battles like the Battle of Coral Sea in May of 1942 and then the Battle of Midway in June of 1942 and a series of operations off of Guadalcanal later in the year. And in holding the line in that first few months of World War II and by mid-43, when industrial capability had kicked in, that's when you see a mass of U.S. aircraft carriers joining the Pacific Fleet, also operating in the Atlantic against German U-boats. And that was when you were really able to see the might of carrier aviation, the what it could bring to the table as far as naval warfare in the Pacific and the Atlantic. And so that's how it essentially evolved from the World War I time frame into the crucible of World War II.
Mentioning the Battle of Midway and Guadalcanal, you've segued beautifully into my next question, which some of the tactics learned through combat, like the thatch weave and such, how are those lessons learned from World War II still applied to today's pilots?
Well, I think it's how it applies to today. You can really, warfare really hasn't changed from in one way. You're always, when you fight one war and then that one ends or a period of conflict ends, and then there may be a period of time between the next war, you're always preparing to fight the next one. So it was for example, the thatch weave was a tactic that was developed by a lieutenant commander named John S. Thatch, and went by Jimmy. And even before the U.S. entered World War II, he was looking ahead to how the U.S. F4F Wildcat would compete against a Japanese Zero. And he was evaluating what the Zero's capabilities were, maneuverability, range, speed versus what the U.S. F4F Wildcat had, which was ruggedness, great armament, and self-sealing fuel tanks, for example, and armor. And he developed the thatch weave, which was primarily a defensive tactic, but which neutralized the capabilities of the Zero, which you really didn't want to try to dogfight one-on-one in an F4F. So I guess you could say how would those tactics influence the future is that's really very much a part of naval aviation to this day, which is really, and it's taken many forms over the years, but it's really constantly evolving tactics and weapons capabilities and looking at how you can take advantage of your strengths and capitalize on the opponent's weaknesses, be it technologically or tactically, to gain an upper hand. And that's, everybody in America or around the world, knows the name Top Gun now because of Hollywood, but that's been in existence at school since 1969. And the Top Gun model of how you become subject matter experts in various weapon systems. You strive to be exact and precise in everything you do. And the ability to study every flight, every engagement to get better and to understand the capabilities of your enemy and just be a school of warfare, a school of aerial combat. That is something that has endured and persists in the fleet today. And I guess also from a macro level, if you look at the aircraft carrier came of age in World War II. And some of the elements of carrier aviation that evolved then are still around now. And just from how a flight deck operates and the launching of airstrikes and the like. So that is an element that carrier aviation, those traditions and those processes and procedures, many of which have endured to this day. And you can look at how, history teaches naval aviation. You can, the carrier's role has evolved. It's gone from fleet engagements in World War II, where you had carrier versus carrier battles, to the carrier actually shifting to prepare the battle space for island hopping campaign. For example, carriers would provide air support for amphibious assaults, and then they would neutralize air power the enemy of the Japanese that might attempt to influence that particular invasion. And then you have the carrier evolving after World War II to not only fleet engagements, but also being platforms to project power ashore in crises response and also in major land wars like Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, on into Iraqi freedom and enduring freedom. And now you're starting to see a shift back into focusing carrier aviation on an engagement at sea again, which a potential war with China over Taiwan. And that would be very much a blue water type of fleet engagement for the carrier, which has always been an element of it, even especially during the Cold War when they were preparing for what an aircraft carrier and naval aviation might do against the Soviet fleet. So it's cyclical. You can see, I mean, the carrier over the years has demonstrated all sorts of capabilities, from blue water sea battles to power projection ashore, and the fact that it's been able to accomplish a lot of those missions and do them well speaks to its versatility and flexibility and adaptability over the years to embrace and make use of new technology.
Continue the conversation of carriers coming to age and aircraft having developed from piston to jets and more modern day technology. How is the rise of unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, how is that transforming today's naval aviation?
Well, it's starting to, and it's going to be even more influential with each passing year. I mean, there are already unmanned aerial vehicle squadrons operating the platform called the Triton, which is actually operational in the Pacific and other areas. And those platforms are really beneficial for long-range reconnaissance and that type of intelligence gathering and what have you. And so that's something that's definitely already in the fleet. And from an aircraft carrier perspective and a strike aircraft perspective, you're starting to see the development of the MQ-25 Stingray, which is going to be a platform that initially focuses on air-to-air refueling, but also can be adapted to other roles. And so where you're going to see UAVs really playing an increasing role in naval operations and in military operations in general, really, is in a concept called unmanned teaming. And so what these platforms are going to do is they're going to work in conjunction with manned aircraft like the F-35 Lightning II, which is the Joint Strike Fighter. And so what these unmanned platforms are going to do in conjunction with the manned platforms is they're really going to enhance the ability of the manned platforms to carry out their mission. So, and also you're going to be able to have those manned platforms be the nodes of information that's going to be coming in from all these unmanned vehicles and unmanned aerial systems, that they're going to work together to enable the aviation to influence the battle space. So it changes by the month on what is literally on the capabilities and of these systems and of these platforms. And it's a constantly evolving dynamic as to how they're going to shape the future of warfare. But it's a continuation of the technological development that has been very much a part of naval aviation from the beginning.
Some of the listeners may not know that the Navy is not just purely about power projection, but it also conducts humanitarian missions to some of the worst hit areas like the Fukushima accident in Japan or even Hurricane Katrina here in the U.S. Do you have any examples that you'd like to share about how the Navy's reached out and assisted both stateside and abroad?
Absolutely. I mean, they help not only other nations, but the United States. That tradition goes way back. I mean, there was an example of the USS Lexington. There was a drought in Tacoma, Washington, which impacted the hydroelectric capability of that city, and it didn't have enough power. And the USS Lexington, which had electric drive engines, actually went to Tacoma and powered the city for a period of time. So it is very much a hallmark of naval aviation over the years to perform those missions in support of other nations. And that is a very effective part of U.S. diplomacy. So naval forces are not only there when shots are being fired and there needs to be a combat force, they're there to build goodwill among our fellow nations. And so you can have, there are a host of examples, but I think that some of the more visible ones that have occurred are the tremendous tsunamis that have occurred and storms in the Pacific. And that can be from industrial and developed countries like Japan to areas that are not financially well off, and the people really are on the brink of starvation if after a storm or if U.S. forces aren't there to assist. And that's the ability of naval forces to be able to respond quickly, to have freedom of movement on the world's oceans, and to not need the rights of be granted rights by countries to base aircraft on their space, on their land. That gives naval aviation a natural ability to respond to crises that no other force really has. Because just like you can have a floating airfield to launch combat missions against an enemy, you can also have a floating airfield within a matter of hours located off of a country in need, and the ability to deliver from the sea things that will help people medically and feed them and just really help them recover from devastating forces of nature. So I think that's a very satisfying part of what naval aviation does. And certainly that's involves the rotary wing community and also involves other aspects of naval aviation. Because like you said, it's not just strike fighters and the ability to do those sorts of missions. It's the versatility that's offered by other platforms that have their own combat roles in surveillance and anti-submarine warfare, for example, but still have the flexibility to perform the humanitarian missions that don't require weapons, but only the will and desire to help others.
The Navy did it right with one of their older mottos, a global force for good, right?
Absolutely. It is a global force for good. And sometimes that to bring out goodness in a situation, it has to involve combat. But a global force for good is the ability to preserve the sea lanes, to make sure the supplies flow from one country to the next across the world's oceans. So that preserves the economy against piracy and other things, and also to respond to help others in need. Absolutely.
So Hill, what are some of the important lessons people can learn from studying the history of naval aviation?
Well, I think it's a story of the ability to adapt is one thing, and that it's a organization within the Navy that was not initially widely accepted. So it had a lot of different technological challenges and tactical challenges that had to overcome. So it's the ability of the individuals who played a role in its development to adapt, to seize opportunities, to expand, to be open to new and different technology, to perform things, to make the seemingly impossible routine, which is if you've ever had the opportunity to observe operations aboard an aircraft carrier, that just shines right through. So I think those are not only the attributes of naval aviation, they're really the attributes of the American story. So as they say, the military a lot is a reflection of the society it serves. And so those same attributes that have driven America to such success in our relatively brief existence, if you consider world history, are the same sort of characteristics that have influenced naval aviation's development. And you also can look at the history. There's the old saying that everybody repeats when they talk about history, but it's very true. You're doomed to repeat the mistakes of history if you don't learn the lesson. And if you spend any time studying history, be it military history or general history, you can find some historic parallel that can guide you. That's not to say that something that happened, say, in the 1930s, and you see something similar in the year 2024, is going to play out exactly as it did in the 30s. You can't just look at it and say, okay, I'll just do exactly what they did, and the outcome is going to be the same. But you can look at certain aspects of a situation that some people may have had to address, be it in the military, in the Navy, or what have you. And there will generally be some guiding principles or some examples of things that will influence your thought and maybe bring you to a better decision. And that, from a naval aviation perspective, that can be tactics, technology, what have you. There are a lot of things that have been done in the past that rise up and are considered in modern operations that, you know, maybe what they did in the past, we should reinstitute it. But maybe it's also a lesson that, hey, we've been down that road before and it wasn't applicable then, and it's probably not going to be applicable now.
Do you have any final thoughts for the listeners today about celebrating naval aviation or where they can find more information or even how they can visit your museum?
Well, yes. The National Naval Aviation Museum is, we've been around since 1963, and we are the Navy's official museum for naval aviation, part of the Naval History and Heritage Command Museum, over which it has cognizance that cover the various aspects of naval history. And what makes the National Naval Aviation Museum unique, I would say, is not only what our holdings are. I mean, we're the third largest air and space museum in the world, but what you get a chance to see when you come visit. And that's really because of our location. We are located on board NAS Pensacola, which is an active naval air station, the Navy's oldest naval air station. So what visitors can get when they visit the Naval Aviation Museum is not only a look at the past, walking through the aircraft and stories of naval aviation's development since 1911, but also walking either into the museum or out of the museum, you look up and you see trainers in action, occasionally the Blue Angels, who are based here, fleet aircraft flying in. So it's a really unique opportunity to be able to witness not only naval aviation's past, but its present and its future in the form of those who are flying those aircraft who are going to be joining the fleet very soon. And I guess when it comes to, really the Navy in general, the Navy's been known for many years, really its entire existence, as the first line of the nation's defense. And a final thought is, when you're, enjoying a product that may have been shipped from overseas to get to your kitchen table or to your living room, or you're seeing a crisis situation arise in the world that maybe doesn't, that has the potential to develop into something else that's wider spread, or you see a storm hit some distant land, it's because of the Navy, naval aviation, other aspects of the Navy that ensure that product reaches your table safely and efficiently at as little cost as possible and is not disrupted. So it's preserving the supply chain of the world. Generally, naval forces are the first to be on scene if there's a crisis anywhere to provide a stabilizing influence. And generally, it's naval forces that are the first line in America's ability to assist the world when things arise, be it natural disaster, health crises, or what have you. So a lot of times, naval forces serve over the horizon, which can make them out of sight, out of mind. But I would urge all those listeners to remember, even though naval forces are over the horizon, they're thousands of miles away, they are such an important part of preserving our way of life and peace and prosperity throughout the world.
As somebody who appreciates aviation and especially naval aviation, I just want to say thank you for coming on our podcast today and for everything that you do to help preserve our naval aviation history.
Well, thank you, Cliff. It's been an honor to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
More information about naval aviation history, from art, books, squadron lineage, photographs, and much more, can be found at history.navy.mil or on this podcast episode's page in the show references. Thanks for joining us today on this episode of Celebrating Naval Aviation History on Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy.